So if you will humor me, I wonder if we could all take a moment of quiet reflection and gratitude and think about the amazing teachers in our lives and how they've shaped us. I'd ask you to take a few seconds to do that now. Thank you for doing that. If I may, I'd like to shift the gratitude focus ever so slightly. Do you know, really know, that you're on someone's list of amazing teachers? I am confident that you are. I will admit that it's something that I personally struggle to acknowledge. It's intimidating and humbling to ponder. But I hope you know, really know, that the work you're doing as teachers of family medicine, is of utmost importance and unparalleled impact. I hope you are keenly aware of that reality and that it invigorates you. So as I begin, to all the teachers that brought us to this moment, and to all the teachers in this room, let me say a deep and profound thank you. As I transition from that gratitude and begin my presentation, I want to be very clear that the work and the innovation and the insights I am presenting are in no way solely mine. I simply have the opportunity to spotlight the accomplishments of many amazing teammates. Pictured here are some of my wonderful colleagues who help run the clinics and the residency in my department. Among them are physicians and behavioral therapists and social workers, administrators, educators, and researchers, department chairs, residency directors, and STFM presidents. I linger here for a couple of reasons. Number one, I really do adore my professional family, and looking at this small subset makes me smile. Number two, I hope to be very clear that everything I suggest moving forward requires a talented, multidisciplinary team. As we get into some of my thoughts and ideas, I think it helps to have some sense of context of where I work. This is the William B. Aycock Family Medicine Building. It houses UNC's Department of Family Medicine and the Family Medicine Center Clinic. Ours is a large department. We have over 70 faculty with a wide range of interests and expertise. We have 14 residents in each of our classes who practice at this location as well as in our rural track sites. It's a dynamic department. The most important thing, though, is to have a mental image of the clinic, our family medicine center. At any given time, we can have 16 to 20 patients, 20 providers seeing patients simultaneously. Prior to the pandemic, we had continuity clinic hours from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday, and again from 8 to noon on Saturday. We also have a co-located urgent care that's staffed by our residents and our faculty that sees patients from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Friday, and again from 8 to 5 on Saturday and Sunday. We have nutrition appointments, pharmacotherapy, behavioral therapy. We offer physical therapy, laboratory services, radiologic services as well. At our busiest, we've seen over 75,000 patients a year from all 100 counties in North Carolina. It is an exciting, complex, and admittedly sometimes hectic place to work. So what qualifies me to come talk to you today about QI and residency education? To be honest, in my mind, I keep revisiting the notion that someone awesome canceled, but I'm gonna set that aside. I think you should know that my earliest roles in the faculty required me to revitalize our quality improvement education for our residents. And because of that work, I served 10 years as associate medical director and eventually medical director of our clinic. And over the past 3.5 years, I've served as the associate chief medical officer for our larger medical center, trying my best to facilitate the work of roughly 160 clinics. So at the end of the day, I think they asked me, because my work and journey in QI as a faculty member very much mirrors yours, I and my colleagues have wrestled with and continue to wrestle with the same quality improvement and education questions that you do. I'm not a senior expert looking back at successes at the end of my journey. I'm still very much in the middle of it, trying to figure it out. Hopefully some of the things we've tried and wrestled with will leave you with some ideas to help us all tackle the next big set of questions that's coming our way. So Margaret asked me if I could reflect on the work we had done in quality improvement and use that experience to provide tangible suggestions for addressing the proposed ACGME changes for residency education. Admittedly, I was initially daunted by that proposition. Margaret politely endured several rounds of refining questions, thank you. Quality improvement and ACGME felt like slightly different fields, but as I really dug into it, I began to see clear connections and the potential for QI principles to be applied as we embrace these ACGME changes. So during our time together today, I hope to reflect on how we implemented a successful QI curriculum in our residency. I hope that we can extract from that some general lessons from our QI journey to address the new ACGME requirements. And I hope to leave you with at least a few very specific tangible ideas you might implement to address those ACGME changes. As I reflect on our quality improvement journey at UNC, I want to point out a few very important realities. First, the work and evolution I am describing took time. Think months and years, not days and weeks. Second, know that we were highly motivated to make a huge change in our department. I'll describe our burning platform in just a minute, but you should know that a collective sense of urgency definitely catalyzed our efforts. Lastly, if I'm being completely transparent, I should share that our current performance is not our best performance. COVID realities have knocked us off our game a bit, and we are having to revisit lessons we learned a long time ago. I fully recognize that I am sharing a tale that began in a different reality, and I am aware that some of the things I suggest will be more challenging now. A moment ago, I mentioned that we benefited from a burning platform that catalyzed our efforts. It's definitely a bit of a retrospective rose-colored lens through which to view the situation, but several years ago, we realized we needed to make a major change in our clinic operations. Our faculty and our residency were expanding. We needed to rethink the use of our space to allow for more providers. Our patients were dissatisfied with long waits to get an appointment and what felt like even longer waits when they got in the building. All of our professional colleagues felt the inertia of our inefficiencies. So we committed ourselves to completely redesigning our physical space, down to the studs, and we planned and rebuilt it using QI methodology. At roughly the same time, we realized that our current efforts to improve clinical metrics were not sustainable. Our model was a small subset of our faculty spending inordinate amounts of time reviewing data, reaching out to patients and providers, and filling out applications to recognition by national quality agencies. We realized we needed to do a better job of hardwiring quality efforts broadly in our clinic. So we set about revisiting and revising all of our standard work. We tried to analyze every moment in the patient's experience to help develop standard work that would allow each teammate to maximally contribute to quality. Importantly, we also began the process of changing our culture around data so that everyone became accustomed to data transparency. Simultaneously, we also realized that our quality improvement education for our residents was not all that it could be. Our third-year residents traditionally completed a group project that they passed from one resident to the next, each doing their part to move the project along. And then they presented the results of their work at Grand Rounds in May. That was about the extent of it. Though well-intended, these projects were often incongruous with larger population and clinic needs, and they often failed to make meaningful impact in patient outcomes. Moreover, residency graduation surveys told us our residents were not confident in their QI skill set, and they were unlikely to pursue QI leadership opportunities in their future settings. So, while we were planning and tearing apart and rebuilding our clinic, and while we were writing and rewriting all of our standard work, we also dedicated ourselves to overhauling our quality improvement teaching for our residents. I know that all of that sounds like a lot of transformation, but the work really was synergistic. The efforts to improve the physical structure, the quality improvement infrastructure, and the residents' education all informed one another as we tried to move forward. And remember, I'm talking years. At the risk of glossing over important details, I would like to highlight key points along the way that I think contributed to our successful transformation on all three fronts. First, I cannot say enough good things about the leadership of our department chair and our medical director at the time. Warren Newton and Sam Weir created a compelling vision of what we could do together. We could all feel the need for improvement, but their carefully considered and well-articulated vision gave us the courage to move forward. Second, we went all in on lean methodology. We studied, we hired coaches, we visited other clinics. We made sure we had a structured approach to problem solving. Let me say here, in case you're not a fan of lean, it was not lean that made the difference, so much as it was that we had a common language and process that allowed us to plan, implement, and monitor all those huge changes. Once we picked a methodology, we used it for everything, literally, from the layout of our clinic rooms, to the way we room patients, to the way we schedule appointments, to the way we manage complicated chronic issues. And we involved everyone in the process. We mapped out Kaizen events. For those of you not in the know, Kaizen is a lean word for change in the good. We mapped out Kaizen events that incorporated all members of our professional family. This broad incorporation of team members was a hugely important step. Everyone contributed to and owned our transformation process and its ultimate product. Everywhere we could, we took the time to write the policies and procedures that would hardwire our change. This may seem obvious, but there's a lot of detailed work there. And lastly, we tried to plan and build in regular audits of our processes at the individual, clinic, and population level. And we built a multidisciplinary team and empowered them to conduct that oversight. Today, I can tell you that we are in a much better place. We have a robust QI infrastructure. We have standard work that empowers team members to maximize their contributions to patient experience and outcomes. We probably have more data than we can manage, but we've normalized the use of data to drive behavior at all levels. And we've created a culture where team members can see their individual contribution to better outcomes. When we started, we could barely manage the process around a couple of chronic disease metrics, diabetes and hypertension. Now, each year, we make meaningful, consistent improvements across dozens of metrics, not just in clinical quality, but also in appointment access and patient satisfaction. We've also significantly improved the educational experience for our residents, as well as our students and fellows. Moreover, our resident feedback tells us that our graduating residents are more likely to engage in future QI activities, and they are more confident in their QI skill set. We've also had the unexpected byproduct of increased and sustained QI scholarly activity from our residents. Lastly, as our QI team has grown and matured, we've been fortunate to participate in and now lead QI collaboratives locally within our system, like the Primary Care Improvement Collaborative, regionally like I3, and nationally through our Faculty Development Fellowship. I could drill down deeper on each of those three topics: the physical structure, the quality improvement infrastructure, and our residents' QI education. But because this is a presentation that seeks to integrate quality improvement and residency education, I'd like to extract and highlight three lessons we learned while improving our quality improvement curriculum. First and foremost, for any QI teaching to work, QI must be an integral part of your culture. Second, any successful QI educational intervention must be experiential. Lastly, any successful QI education intervention will involve real efforts to improve patient care and will result in real practice change. If you will, let's consider those one by one. How do we live out this first lesson? Simply put, we talk about quality every time we gather. That's not hyperbole. We have monthly seminars that are focused on teaching and improving quality, like our TACI conference. We've even revised old conferences like Morbidity and Mortality to focus more on quality. We call it Quality and Safety Improvement, or QASI. And yes, I'm aware we have an acronym problem. Beyond meetings specifically dedicated to quality, we work quality into our other gatherings as well. Whenever we gather as an entire clinic or even in our smaller care teams, quality measures are always analyzed and discussed. I mentioned earlier that as we hardwired our changes, we empowered a multidisciplinary team to oversee all our work. Perhaps one of the most important aspects of our quality-focused culture is this clinical systems improvement team that meets weekly. Residents, while on their QI rotations, attend and contribute mightily to this team. So as you can see, it is nearly impossible for our residents to go a whole week without attending some meeting or conference that is focused on quality. Beyond simply talking about quality in many settings, we use data everywhere we can to drive our conversations. By virtue of our curriculum, our residents are an integral part of these data-driven discussions. This is but one example of the many metrics that we analyze. We follow patient outcomes like A1C and blood pressure, but we also track time to third available appointment, average cycle time, and call responsiveness, so our residents can learn and see how all of these factors impact the delivery of quality care. As I move away from this first lesson, let me simply say this. If you aspire to improve your residents' quality improvement education, do not start by designing an educational intervention. Instead, start by making sure QI is a part of your culture. Design, implement, and sustain meaningful QI in your practice. Then involve your residents in that work. Let's move on to the second lesson. We believe that residents must do QI work to understand QI work. Our three-year curriculum puts residents at every level in the middle of QI projects that rely on their participation and leadership. In the first year, they are introduced to basic terms and concepts with a self-change project. In the second year, as they participate more in our TACI conference, residents are able to propose and study several rapid cycles of small change. And in the third year, our residents collectively undertake an ambitious year-long project that's now aligned with population and clinical needs. As I move away from the lesson about experiential learning, let me say that I'm aware of the presence of lectures and online modules. I think lectures and online modules about QI are a great way to introduce quality improvement concepts, but they should only be the beginning. This last truth is perhaps the simplest. QI educational interventions must involve real patients and real change. Our residents design and implement QI projects that improve the care we deliver and make lasting change in our practice and our healthcare system. We state that high expectation of them and they live up to it. What you see here is a resident-designed diabetes self-management handout. It was one of our first successful projects. It was implemented first in our office by residents, then it was incorporated across our entire healthcare system, and ultimately it was made a part of our initial Epic build. Since then, our residents have moved the needle on colorectal cancer screening, pediatric vaccination rates, and readmissions after discharge, just to name a few. Certainly, these sustained clinical changes are important for our patients. But perhaps even more important is the confidence that comes from making a significant, lasting impact. If our residents see they can improve quality during residency, we've learned that they're more likely to continue doing so after they graduate. Real projects with real struggles and real successes increase the likelihood of QI success after residency. Okay, so far I've told you about our QI journey, and I've shared three important lessons that we learned as we augmented our residents' quality improvement education. Now is the moment I want to try and connect our past QI knowledge and experience with future changes proposed by the ACGME. On the left is advice I wrote about our curriculum a few years ago and just restated a few slides back. On the right is an excerpt from Warren Newton's and Michael McGill's recent article in the Journal of the American Board of Family Medicine regarding these new ACGME changes. They wrote, "A major lift for residencies is to implement the idea that the practice is the curriculum. This is more than having patient panels, meaningful cost and quality metrics, and a patient and community advisory panel. The core idea of enabling the practice to drive the curriculum is that residency clinical practices should be exemplars, modeling outstanding care across the continuum, constantly improving, and making a difference in communities. it seems to me that the ABFM and the ACGME are imploring us to make QI a part of our culture, to continuously design, implement, and sustain meaningful improvement in our practices so that they can be exemplars. And we must involve residents in that important work. Perhaps that is one of the most important things I can say today. Do not be timid or hesitant about your QI aspirations. You've always known that this work is important to your patients. Now, be further emboldened by the awareness that it is vitally important to the future of family medicine residency education. When we began our time, I said I hoped we would discuss how we implemented a successful QI curriculum in our residency and that we would apply some general lessons from our QI journey to address new ACGME requirements. Lastly, I said I hoped that we would leave with at least a few specific ideas to address these proposed changes. I'd like to address that last outcome now, focusing specifically on ideas around master adaptive learning and family medicine program panel management. The proposed ACME changes include specific language about a residence continuity panel. If you haven't seen it before, take a moment to read some of that language here. We've been wrestling with the issue of panel management as it relates to patient access. I'm hopeful that our experience might provide some tangible ideas to help address these new ACGME changes. We currently have a panel management process that I think will help address this requirement. I'd like to briefly describe it and its underpinnings to you. First and foremost, we have a collective commitment to continuity. We measure it, we monitor it, we talk about it. We think it's a key component of our residents feeling like a real family doc as quickly as they can. Because we place such a high value on continuity, we have a clear definition of patient attribution, and we monitor for unassigned patients. Because we put such an emphasis on continuity, we politely demand of our partner programs that we know their rotation schedules roughly a year in advance, so we can predict with decent accuracy how many clinics each resident will be doing each week of the year. And lastly, over time, we've developed a target panel size for every faculty at every level and every resident learner as well. We also have a dedicated process leader who is tasked with monitoring our patient panels. She is an influential lead social worker in our clinic, and she is highly regarded by our residents. Epic, our EMR, has great panel reporting capacity, and our process leader knows how to do that well. Because of the importance we place on continuity, we consistently discuss percent continuity and time to third available. In fact, we often award those with outstanding continuity and access with the glue stick and rubber ducky awards. The glue stick for continuity is self-evident. The rubber ducky is a bit convoluted. If you imagine a bathtub filled with water, your appointment supply is the drain. Your appointment demand is the spigot. The resident with the lowest water level or best time to third available gets the rubber ducky award. The outcome is high resident buy-in. Furthermore, all of our teammates, from the folks that schedule appointments to the folks that check in patients to the folks that see the patients in the room, all of us prioritize continuity, especially at the time of scheduling and whenever we room an unassigned patient. So the result of all this is a standard work around patient reassignment that begins each March, the day after we learn our interns' names. There are two phases of review from every giving and every receiving primary care provider, and the graduating residents carefully reassign their patients to their resident teammates. After that redistribution in the spring, resident panel size is monitored every month to promote excellent access and continuity rates. So, how does this relate to the proposed ACGME changes regarding panel management? In our efforts to promote continuity, We created a system that already allows us to balance panels across age, gender, diagnosis, preferred language, and social determinants of health. I think we may have already met this requirement. Let's turn to the requirements around massive adaptive learning. These proposed changes around direct observation and competency-based assessment are harder to summarize in one easy slide. So again, I turn to the words of Newton and Miguel. They wrote that to optimize CBME, residencies will need to develop learning environments in which residents co-create their education, reviewing assessments frequently with clinical mentors. This is the hard part. This, in turn, will require systems for capturing observations in real time and collating assessments for residents, faculty, mentors, and the Clinical Competency Committee. Similar to our panel management process, we have a direct observation and Clinical Competency Committee process that might get us partway towards meeting these new ACGME requirements. When the milestones first came out, we studied them deeply, and we had faculty and resident education sessions to immerse everyone in that new language. And every class that we welcome into our family, we continued to immerse in the language of milestones. We quickly recognized the limits of our available and existing end-of-rotation evaluations, and we worked wherever we could to create competency-based assessment forms. We realized, though, that what we really needed was a mechanism to capture real-time direct observation and associate that observation with milestones. So our genius residency director at the time created the M3 app. The app alone, though, wouldn't be successful if we didn't create a culture where direct observation and feedback were highly valued. Once we had a mechanism for real-time capture of direct observation, we organized ourselves to maximize our Clinical Competency Committee meeting. We created a faculty pre-meeting wherein we could identify any gaps in our data, and we would alert relevant faculty members who are working with those residents in the future to make them aware of the opportunity for meaningful observations. We also implemented a resident milestone self-evaluation to be considered alongside our direct observation data. All of that information is then carefully collated by the resident's advisor and assigned to the milestone achievement dashboard prior to the Clinical Competency Committee meeting. And so the outcome is a competency committee meeting that is effectively anchored in direct observation rather than faculty guesstimation. And now, several iterations in, it is surprisingly efficient, but we are always striving to refine our process. So getting back to those ACGME proposals, how does this apply? Just like we organized ourselves around continuity, here we organized ourselves around a mechanism for capturing direct observation. And subsequently, the process of collating assessments for residents, faculty, and the CCC came into focus pretty quickly. So if I had to distill our experience thus far into three tangible, exportable lessons, I would say this. Make your practice a QI exemplar and involve your residents in that work. Solve for continuity. Panel management and targets will follow. Organize a process for capturing direct observation in real time. By no means will these lessons address all the proposed ACGME changes, but I sincerely believe that they will help you with some of the heaviest lifts. This would be a wise place for me to stop. But in addition to ACGME changes, I have one more challenge I'd like us to consider. I'd like to present this challenge by describing my last several weeks at work as I considered and prepared for this presentation. Despite my best efforts, I was seated on the jury of an attempted murder trial. Shortly thereafter, my entire family, including a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old, became symptomatic with COVID. And I recovered just in time to welcome 190 new first-year medical students to campus. So why am I up here moaning? How in the world is this challenge applicable to you? We all have our civic or familial duties from time to time. we will all have an illness that slows us down. And we all have times of the year that are busier than others. None of this is new or particularly challenging to such a robust body. Let me tell you what I think is new and very challenging, and that I fear that we are underestimating. In our system, at least, we have staffing shortages in nearly every position in our system. Labs take longer to come back, the patient rooming process is slowed, hospitalized patients are angry because they can't get food, important point of care teammate resources are simply no longer there. Though our COVID hospitalization rates and death rates have slowed down, our COVID-related employee absences have not. Across our system, I checked this morning, we're still running over 100 absences each day. And in the midst of all this, in my system at least, we've experienced a relatively unprecedented number of physicians leaving academic medicine. Fortunately for me, they're all specialists, but even that makes getting a referral harder. So I simply wanted to say, if things feel harder than they used to be, I think it's because they are. So how does this relate to implementing QI and tackling ACDME changes? I don't think we can let any one faculty member be responsible for figuring these things out anymore. It can't be just your medical director or just your program director. It's going to take a team. Do you remember that collage of my brilliant and wonderful teammates way back at the beginning of my talk? I know as junior faculty, we were all tasked to tackle a big project or a big issue and champion it to success. It was an honor to be asked, but I'm not so sure that that hustle culture model of singling out rising superstars works anymore in our current reality. We're going to have to lean on each other just to see patients, much less to address the changes like the ACDME or whatever the next opportunity is. And so my challenge is this: can we think of a way to address these things together? This collective impact model is one possibility. We use this model at home in several of our national collaboratives. It builds upon a backbone of support and a common agenda to leverage shared measurements, mutually reinforcing activities, and continuous communication to really help highly structured collaboratives achieve substantial impact on big scale problems. A backbone of support, a common agenda, reinforcing activities. As I was reflecting on this model and the challenge of tackling big issues in this post-COVID reality, it struck me that we may have already found our solution. At the outset of my talk, I said I hoped you had a head full of ideas. I meant that. I also hope, though, that you are leaving with a head full of connections. Reach out to the leader of that excellent session you attended. Follow up with the author of that awesome poster you saw. Join a collaborative that will help you address an issue in your home practice. Stay engaged. I think it's more important now than ever. I started my presentation with gratitude. Let me end there as well. Thank you for your engagement during our time together. Most importantly, thank you for all you are already doing to address these big questions. I look forward to questions you may have of me. Thank you.